In this episode, we're talking to Kieran Goy, who has taught over 80,000 humans how to live more deliberate lives. And we have Sian May, head of school at Alice Smith School. Let's get into it right now.
Welcome to the Alice Smith Pod on Purpose podcast. Get ready to be inspired and informed as we uncover the stories of intentional impact and innovation.
So good morning or good afternoon, wherever you are in the world, to you both. Kieran and Sian, it's great to talk to you. Kieran, tell us first of all where you're chipping in from.
I am chipping on from the humid Singapore, where it has been pouring for the past couple of weeks, but thankfully it has stopped and now I can go play golf. So I'm happy.
Okay, great. Well, I'm dying to talk to you, dying to find out more about these deliberate lives. Sian, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm at the JB primary campus and we've just had our exploration pathways and they've just finished up. So I'm just sat in a quiet room in a corner of the campus, looking forward to this chat.
Fantastic. I've been looking forward to this too. Kieran, tell us about your experience, because I'm dying to know more about these deliberate lives and 80,000 individuals. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, it seems like I just put that number as a massive flex, but I promise you it actually is true. It's probably best I take you back a few years to how I then ended up coming into this, industry. But when I was younger, I actually got diagnosed with juvenile diabetes when I was, I think, 6 or 7. And I was surrounded by doctors perpetually, and they became my idols, effectively. And so I sort of from that point said, you know what? I want to do medicine. This is my dream. This is my goal. I'm going to go. And then, lo and behold, we fast forward to when I was fortunate enough to get into University of Melbourne in Sydney to study medicine. And I started seeing people around me not get offers, and I got an offer, and I felt really apathetic. I didn't really care. So I was worked so hard for all this time to get to a point where I didn't actually want what I actually was after. And it was that point that I sort of disconnected. I took a year off to find myself and I found a job in that sense. And the job was actually presenting workshops to students. It was about all how to study. It was how to actually develop metacognition. And I absolutely loved it, as well as tutoring. And so I did that across a few years and then was fortunate enough to move to Singapore and start Elevate Education there. And that's where I ended up speaking to the 80 odd thousand human beings to help them live a little bit more deliberately. So that's the story.
Gosh, okay. So tell us more then about these 80,000 individuals and this deliberate thinking.
Yeah. So I think one of the main assumptions I think we make at schools or just generally as human beings is that we all have a brain, but we don't necessarily know how to use it. Like when I go back to school and I go back to even the workplace, I was never said, hey, here are some really clear psychological and cognitive tools. This is how your brain works, even though it's in charge of everything. And I think that fundamental assumption is a gap, because if we don't actually know how a brain works, and that's largely driving a lot of our behavior, then how on earth can we actually navigate ourselves to the world and flourish? So it seems like a little bit of tension there. And so this whole deliberate lifestyle, if you will, came from let's teach explicitly these tools based on cognitive science, based on literature, and hopefully we can increase the probability that humans can use those skills. And if they use it, then hopefully they can, you know, make their impact in the world.
Okay, right. Gosh. So dying to unpack this just a little bit more in that case, but we'll come on to that shortly. I understand as well that you've done some work as a Harvard Business Publishing Leadership Facilitator. Gosh, that's quite hard to get out. Tell us a bit more about that and the neuroscience-based tools for leaders as well.
Yeah, that's been a really interesting, let's call it transition, because I was so used to presenting to students and them thinking that I was kind of funny because I had an Australian accent. Honestly, that was literally what was the novelty. And then it sort of transitioned into adult learning. And I'm, you know, speaking to people who are slightly older than me, they're executives at Fortune 500 to 5,000 companies. And initially there was that imposter syndrome with it. But I think the transition was interesting because it reminded me that at a first principle level, all humans have problems. So all humans have problems. They just manifest themselves slightly differently. And in the business world, it seemed that to be the case. And so you seemed a lot of leaders that, you know, lacked some of those tools to help build teams and scale humans and push forward. And a lot of it comes down to self-awareness. And I think the quote that always reminds me of this is by, I think, Socrates. And he says, the unexamined life is a life not worth living. And when I have that, that seems to be the case a lot of the time when I'm speaking to leaders and incorporating that neuroscience is they all want to be great leaders, but sometimes they just lack the information and the knowledge and the skills to actually do that. So that's where we try keyword to close the gap.
Okay, I understand. Thank you for that. Sian, it's amazing talking to Kieran about all of this. Why were you keen on Kieran being on this podcast?
I've known Kieran probably, I'm thinking 4 or 5 years now, which is kind of crazy and a bit scary. And actually, I drew on Kieran's expertise in a previous life, and it was all around, how do you have these life hacks? I mean, that's how I would see them as an adult. I would say, why wouldn't we make these things available to other adults? Why wouldn't we make them available to children? And again, accelerate wisdom. I think that's what I spoke about in the last episode, actually, was acceleration of wisdom. So all the tools that Kieran brings, why not have them at our disposal? And why not enhance things more quickly and live more intentionally? So yeah, for me, it was easy. It's a no-brainer.
And how do you see collaborations then working between yourself and Kieran in the future?
I mean, Kieran and I have spoken about there's a possibility that we would link up and partner on something in the future. We're at a kind of critical point in our strategic roadmap here at Alice Smith. And certainly Kieran is someone I would go to possibly be a key player in the future. But we haven't hashed anything out. But certainly the work is riveting. Students give all this work and all this kind of practice hugely positive feedback, because as Kieran said, you're often not taught how to use your own brain. And we make a lot of assumptions about young people and their ability to do that. And we talk about self-regulation, for example, without necessarily enabling a child to practice what that might look like at different ages.
No, I see. Okay, thank you for that. I'd love to talk to you both about intentional impact. I'd love some thoughts from each of you regarding this. Kieran, maybe if you can go first.
Yeah, I have a tendency to bring up all these random quotes, so I'm going to feel free to keep a quote tracker if you like. But I think this one's by Carl Jung, and he says, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate. And when I say that one out loud, that's where I think the intentionality and deliberateness comes in. Is unless you're really consciously thinking about your life, thinking about what it might look like, thinking about the impact that you can have, then if you do make an impact, then maybe it's just serendipity. Maybe it's just luck. And so I think that idea of intentional impact is saying, hey, I have a plan, I have an idea. I'd like to try and make this a reality by maybe sheer force of will or by scaling and bringing it along with people. But at least I'm going to give that a go. And so I think that that lends itself of intentional, I suppose, impact is very much that experimental mindset. I'm willing to experiment. I'm willing to make a few mistakes. But ultimately, my main yardstick is how much do I learn per unit time? So that's sort of what intentionality means to me, at least. But I think Carl Jung knew it better than I did.
Sean, tell me a bit about intentional impact then at Alice Smith School. And I'm thinking that everything that Kieran is saying is absolutely perfect. But in the face of social media, which is calling people, you know, social media is probably the exact opposite of intentional impact, where we just get sometimes sucked into social media and we can end up wasting time and having no impact without any intention at all. Tell us a little bit about how that looks at Alice Smith School.
I think the big thing for us about intentional impact is going back to our key purpose. So obviously we have our purpose statement. We're very early days in terms of that being meaningful to the whole community. But also we're looking at our individual purpose and impact through our purpose-driven work with Harriet Watt. So for us, stripping it back to what does your life look like when it is examined, if I do the inverse with the Socrates quote, yeah, absolutely. For us, it's why are we here? What's the purpose as an educator? What's the purpose of being a school? What's the purpose of making friendships? What's the purpose of learning? And actually, one of the simple yardsticks that we use that's much more colloquial is, why are you learning this? If you can't tell us, if you can't articulate that, then something is breaking down. Because for you to be a learner, you have to feel motivated. It has to have meaning for you. Or we have to at least enable you to make sense or make meaning. So that's a key part of what we're doing. And certainly we hope the purpose work will drive some of that.
That's amazing. It really is. And Kieran, is that the kind of typical way that you see intentional impact being applied in a school like Alice Smith?
I think it is. I think Shan's actually right on the money because, and I'm going to riff here with you. I think one of the things I've been talking or thinking about is that we use the word learning a lot and we use the word learners a lot. And then when you interface that with intentionality, it's almost sitting there being like, when a new thing comes along, we're always quick to saying, how do I learn this? How do I get closer to it? But in reality, I think the opposite is true. How do you become a great unlearner? Because if you're able to then be intentional, then you're unlearning. What are the habits? What are the beliefs? What are the philosophies? What are my thinking that don't serve me, that I need to unlearn? That if I did unlearn, push me closer to what I actually need to learn? And another quote I think is by Charlie Munger, and he says, it's much easier to avoid stupidity than it is to seek brilliance. And I feel like that might align here if you're being intentional, is really trying to push towards that unlearning mindset and learning mindset in that intentionality.
And is this the idea of the anti-vision in that case?
You have beat me to it, 100%. Yeah. I think it's like one of those things, whenever you go to like a motivational talk, everyone's like, you got to have a vision, you got to dream big, you got to try and achieve. And sometimes that can be really gripping, right? Because you're appealing for opportunity for gain, and all the behavioral economists will be on that. But loss aversion is pretty big too. That's a large driver of human behavior. And so when you ask yourself, what would be an anti-vision? Where do I not want to go? What, when I think of, makes me cringe at the very thought of that being a possibility, whether you're a teacher, you're a leader, or you're a student? And I think when I did that for myself and I, you know, really painted this bleak picture of what my life could be, I felt a little bit more motivated because I wanted to get away from that. And then I got closer to where I wanted to be. And so it was more like a bit of a meditation on that for myself, being like, anti-vision seemed to motivate me a little bit more. And I wonder if that could help with some other people.
So you mentioned there about loss aversion. Is that the idea that people will work harder to avoid something that's painful as opposed to working towards something which is beneficial to them? Is that the idea of that?
Yeah, basically. Like this was coined by Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman in his book, Think Fast, Think Slow. If anyone has ever got through that book, you are lying. That is the biggest trudge of all time. I've only read the paper, which was like 20 pages, and I thought that was hard, but you're spot on. It's basically saying like for like. If I get, you know, was saying I'll give you a dollar versus you'll lose a dollar, like for like, you'll be much more sensitive to the losing a dollar than gaining the dollar.
Okay. And is this the kind of thing that you talk about on your podcast? I understand you got a podcast called Brain Tools. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. We sort of try in the podcast because that was just more of an itch to scratch. It started during COVID. And I think like a lot of people, I was just bored. And I was like, oh, I studied neuroscience at university. Shall we bring this back in vogue? And just started basically thinking about the problems that we had and then breaking it down through the neuroscience and looking at the literature, saying, how would you solve this problem through a brain science lens? And one of the commonalities always was loss aversion. It just kept coming up time and time and time again. But then trying to make use of the theory, bridging sort of a theory and practice to say, hey, this sounds nice. It might be a common thread of humanity, but how would you actually use it in your life? And so, yeah, the Brain Tools podcast is basically us riffing on our problems and then just trying to solve it through brain tools effectively.
Okay, right. So tell us more about the podcast then. I mean, what other kind of things do you tend to discuss on the episodes?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. I think one that was a really big thing, we spoke to our listeners about it and they were talking about habits. So habits seem to be one of those things, because I think this was around the start of the year. And it's the classic, right? People have a New Year's resolution. They're pretty pumped. They're motivated. And then 3 weeks later, they've regressed to the mean and they're probably given up on their habits. And so the question was why? Mm-hmm. Why is it so hard to actually entrench that? And so an example of that that we spoke on the podcast was, you know, James Clear's Atomic Habits. You know, how do you make a habit, you know, attractive? How do you make it easy? How do you make it obvious? And how do you make it satisfying? And it was these type of tools that said, oh, if you can do that, then you can increase the probability of making sure you form that habit. You don't guarantee it. And I think that's when on the Brain Tools podcast, we try to think in probabilities, not certainties, and say, how can you nudge the odds in your favor across time? So that's just an example of putting forward habits.
Sean, I can see you nodding there when Kieran mentioned about James Clear Atomic Habits. I'm guessing you've read the book or listened to the audio book at least.
I have read the book. I also started the other book thinking Slow and Fast, or Fast and Slow, forgive me. And I didn't finish it. So Kieran's quite right. But yeah, there are habits that I've definitely developed that I've maintained and try to keep in my own life, like 7 minutes. I always work out for 7 minutes every day. That's a commitment I've made and I've maintained. But actually some of it is not having binary thinking about win or losing. Sometimes it's just consistency that I think can be a big motivator. So certainly, yeah, there's all these habits we're all picking up all the time. And like you said, we're unlearning some of those binary thoughts of thinking win or losing to maintain habits.
Kieran, I'd love to jump back to this anti-vision idea, because sometimes people say that if you focus on the negative, then you end up being pulled in towards that negative. And the analogy sometimes people use is, you know, driving down a road. If there's nothing on the road at all, apart from one post, then sometimes people can end up crashing into that post because they're focusing on the thing that they're trying to avoid. Tell us a little bit about that and how you counter that.
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think, as we know, human beings, we love to think in binaries, to Shan's point. We love a yes or no. It makes it cognitively easy. Like you look at, you know, the attention economy right now, and you know, you can argue that attention spans are getting shorter. You can argue that it's becoming increasingly hard to focus. And so you just look at the number of books that are coming out on focus. I tell you, it's one new one each week. And so I think to your point on the anti-vision, it's twofold. Number one, it's probably novelty bias, which is we're so used to thinking about a vision, right? So that it can almost fall on deaf ears. Sometimes you need to change the language of something to then reinvigorate the actual principle behind it. And then I think the second thing is you never want to view something in isolation like we do. So when you do create an anti-vision, the next step is actually to create a vision. So it's the idea that you look at, this is where I want to get away from, and then this is where I want to head towards. And sometimes your vision is exactly the inverse of your anti-vision, but seldom is it. There's sometimes exceptions to it. And I'm always reminded about hygiene theory, which sounds like a really weird thing to bring up, but it's in HR, which is like, it always says there are things that increase dissatisfaction and things that increase satisfaction. But just because you solve something on the dissatisfaction side doesn't make someone more satisfied. And just because you make someone more satisfied doesn't take away the dissatisfaction. And so I sort of try and tackle it from both angles, as you said, so you can actually see where you want to avoid, but also where you want to head to.
Okay, so in other words, avoiding the thing that you don't want without an understanding and a clear idea of what you do want, you're saying that you need to have both of them in tandem?
I think so, yeah. I just think so. So in the same way of, like, say, Alice Smith with the vision that's been painted, I think it's always really interesting to say, if we weren't realizing our vision, what would that look like? Just because I think sometimes with indicators, we can focus on the positively geared things. And sometimes you want to look at data on both sides. So it's just, as you said, an example of trying to see 100% of the picture as opposed to maybe one half of it.
Sean, I'd love to jump back to you on this concept for a second, because all of this is fascinating. I could carry on talking about this all day. How does it actually translate into life in school?
In terms of loss of vision? And the anti-vision.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's something we keep in mind all the time, because you know where you don't want to go. So in terms of whether that's well-being indicators for students, whether that's something that you're seeing in work-based practices, whether that's falling behind and not leveraging evidence, whether that's almost behaving as if 2024 is not here. You know, we have an inflection point in history right now. We have all these different geopolitical things and climate change. We have massive landscapes that we're operating in. And of course, one of the big fears that school leaders will have is that we're not actually acknowledging those. We're not working within them. And certainly in our parent community, what's very clear is that industries are changing rapidly and work is changing rapidly. And there is a sense at which we don't want education just to jog to the side or race because other industries are, but we also need to work out, what does that mean for us? So yes, that black hole of not tackling the realities is always where your mind goes in terms of an anti-vision.
Yes, it's amazing to hear about this being played out in real life there. Kieran, tell me about the decision journal. I understand this helps with decision making.
Well, it's meant to, at least, that's for sure. I think the decision journal as a tool came about asking myself anyway. And as I said, a lot of this is just scratching my own itch, to be honest with you. And then sometimes people actually say, oh, that might be useful. And I ask myself the question, how many decisions have I made in my life? And then the second question I ask is, like, how many of those decisions did I actually make deliberately, intentionally? Like, I actually had a process. Like, I actually sat there and said, like, the classic one that I look at, my inflection point in my life was moving to Singapore. I literally said, oh yeah, I'm just going to move to Singapore. There was no intentionality about it. I look back and be like, oh yeah, look, it's worked out well, but it wasn't exactly like I planned. And so the decision journal was something that I then looked at and borrowed a lot from investors, where they basically would keep a log of all the investments that they made. And then 2-3 years later, they'd look back and say, do I regret making that investment? And it's a way to actually combat hindsight bias, which is the whole, I knew it all along, which is we have a tendency to look back at history and say, oh yeah, I knew that was going to happen. I knew the global financial crisis was going to take place. I knew AI was going to push forward. But at that time, you probably didn't have that information. And so, yeah, the decision journal is very much like trying to be really intentional about some of the bigger decisions that you make, understanding the difference between reversible and irreversible decisions. So if I can reverse it, then maybe I need to move fast. I need to experiment. I need to try something to learn. Or if it's irreversible, I need to probably take my time and think, hey, this is actually a really big decision to make. Let's gather some data. Let's actually talk to some people. And so it was just a way of trying to, again, be more intentional and deliberate. And it's helped. But also sometimes you look back and you cringe at some of the decisions that you made because you thought it was a great idea and you're like, I probably shouldn't have made that.
And then how do we get the balance right between that intentional impact in the decision-making along with the idea of free will? And I'm thinking about how our upbringing shapes so many of our thought processes and our decision making. How do we shake that off in order to make the right decisions without just going for the instinctive answer that we think is correct just based on our upbringing?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think one of the things that psychologists will talk about a lot is primal wounds. And it's the concept that, again, as you probably know, that, you know, there's a lot of trauma that we face in our lives from 0 to 5, but we'll never remember it. And that has a really big impact on shaping us. And I think I always borrow a quote from Marcus Aurelius with this concept of free will, which is, be tolerant of others and strict with yourself. And I think in this way, like, yes, the stuff has happened. Yes, it's shaped you, but you do have the ability to sit there and say, hey, what are some of the decisions that I'd like to make moving forward? And yes, the probability of getting to those might be low because you've been so shaped, right? Your subconscious is pushing towards directions that you're not even aware of. But I would say that at least in trying to be a bit more conscious of it, you're probably going to increase the odds that you get to where you want to be. That is also wrestling with the fact that you do need to overcome analysis paralysis. You can't sit there in a spreadsheet or a document listing out all the pros and cons like we do when we're going to break up with someone. Like, you can't do that. But you need to be mindful of finding that balance, I think.
And then, Sean, again, hearing about all of this, and, you know, no pressure on you at all, but clearly the impact on children has a big impact on the rest of their lives. But tell us a little bit about that in school and some of the examples that you can see about that playing out.
I think decision-making, I mean, it's always at the heart of everything. And often in my role, to give you an example, I'm always working through other people. So you're working through multiple layers of decision-making. You're never making a decision in full knowledge, and you're never making a decision in isolation. It's impossible to do that, despite the fact you can't always make the process completely visible to everybody. So it's an interesting dilemma. I think one of the things that I have been quite intentional about, and some of my colleagues know this, is when I make a decision and at what point I will make the decision, and even at the point of the day. A bit of a fan of Dan Pink's chronotypes, that actually I think I'm a lark. I make far better decisions in the morning. I definitely have a drop off in the afternoon, and then I have an inflection again in the evening where I'm probably really good to make a decision again. So we can't always make decisions in real time in those ways, because we make multiple micro decisions every day, which people are counting on us, you know, for their safety or for an operational aspect of convenience. So what we do try and do is, when we know it's a slow decision and it's intentional, and it's a bit like Kieran's bar there, is it reversible or irreversible? Because I'm very happy with iterative decisions if I know the model can be improved continuously. And of course, we're trying to model to the students that sometimes you can be brave and actually you don't let the perfect get in the way of the good, but you actually start to operate something and you refine as you go. You can't do that with everything, but in some things you can model that way. But yet, I mean, I can't even imagine the number of decisions we make in a day, and what the threshold is before it's a micro decision, what's a choice and what's a decision. We do talk about this at leadership level a lot, but certainly we always try and slow our thinking down and work out what's available to us when we're making something.
Well, I'm glad you're doing that, not me, Sean. Kieran, tell me something about turning a reversible decision into an irreversible decision, the idea of burning the ships so that you can't go back.
Yeah, so just for context, the reversible irreversible comes from Jeff Bezos. So definitely someone smarter than me. And I think he put it in his one of his shareholder letters that he put forward. And I think there's an element of saying, yes, burn the ships and you can't turn back and you need to go forward, because that helps with cognitive ease. It makes it easy, right? You can move forward to execution, because a lot of people will spend their time deliberating back and forth and back and forth. And I think that is actually the biggest problem when it comes to decision-making, is people actually treat it like a multiple choice test.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, when we answer a multiple choice test, people go, okay, I've got A, B, C, D. Process of elimination is the most popular. I'll compare A to D, B to C, and I'll try and rule it all out. That's actually one of the worst ways to answer multiple choice questions, because what you end up doing is you narrow frame. What you should do is you should actually look at the question, answer the question yourself, and then compare your answer to all the answers in front of you, and then actually make that comparison. And so to come all the way back to your point on, you know, the difference between that and, I suppose, leveraging sometimes burning the ships, I think that still just comes down to the basic point. What decision are you making? Like, a lot of the time people don't actually know the decision they're making. And, you know, I think Albert Einstein puts this better than I can. He says, if I've got 60 minutes to solve a problem, I'll spend 55 minutes defining it and 5 minutes on the solution. And I think staying in the problem space when it comes to decisions can be very, very helpful, because it then helps you to understand, what's the decision I need to make? What's the best course of action moving forward? And to your point, is it actually necessary to burn the ships to get to the desired outcome that I require?
I see. Okay. This is all incredible stuff. I'm keeping an eye on time here because I really could talk about this all day. And Kieran, I must say, I'm super impressed with your internal database of quotes that you're able to retrieve at the click of the finger. Where can people find out more about you if they wanted to look you up online?
Yeah, so my website's www.kierangoy.com and I have all the templates up there. And then, yeah, the Brain Tools podcast is probably the place to go. You know, we release podcast episodes that are like sort of 5-10 minutes long. So hopefully that can help you if you get some of those tools and incorporate it into your practice.
Perfect. Well, we'll put a link to both those in the show notes. But Kieran, thank you so much for being here. It's been really good talking to you.
An absolute pleasure. Thanks so much, Simon. Thanks so much, Sian.
And Sian, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for being here as well. Thank you.
No, thanks, Kieran. Thanks, Simon. Thoroughly enjoyed it. It flew by.
So there we are. That brings us to the end of this episode. If you have any questions at all, then please do get in touch with the school. But in the meantime, thank you for listening to this, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.